Susan will come.
Nice day here.
Has come with us. Has come, from the chance to be with us this evening. From before she decided to dedicate her life totally to this practice, Susan had a long and very successful career as an actress and as a film producer, movie maker. In fact, she had her own production company for over 20 years. About 25 years ago, she went to San Francisco Zen Center and moved in. She's been there for a quarter of a century at this time. Susan is currently president of San Francisco Zen Center, one of the senior teachers. And Susan has had many, many different roles and jobs up at San Francisco Zen Center. And when we were coming over here tonight, she told me that her most favorite job at San Francisco Zen Center was fundraising. Did I get that right?
No, but...
Susan, welcome. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
Before I start, I'm totally distracted by that amazing calligraphy. And I'm wondering if you could tell me whose calligraphy it is and if you want to share what it says.
It was given to me in 1985 when I was in Japan with Koichi Suzuki. For our transmission. And at the end of the ceremony, he took me to see Noyoshi. Relatively at the time, very strict practicer, very strict noble man. Very strict. And he wrote this out for me. And it says, in effect, in Tobin's words, the sound of the mountain stream is his voice, and sound of the stream is his voice, the color of the mountains is his tongue. Mm-hmm. And so that was a special gift many years ago,
yeah.
A long time ago.
Yeah.
It's quite beautiful, and it was, I could see the living and the past living in it. I could see the ghosts.
Yeah.
So it was haunting. Thank you for letting me know what it says. I'm not going to talk about ghosts. That was last weekend. Recently, I was part of a team that offered some classes what we called compassionate caregiving. And the semester I participated in was focusing on old age, sickness, death, and grief. And together we studied various ways to be aware of the elements of these processes. So one of my co-teachers was a doctor, and the other was a grief counselor, and they had a lot of experience in the kind of building blocks of what constitutes aging and sickness and death and grief. And when we look at grief, which I say is a response to an awareness of something that we don't want to change, changing, we worked on discovering skillful ways to be with others who are grieving. That was one of the points of the class. And during this time, I had one of those little aha moments, which It has to do with that one of the basic teachings of Buddha, of the Buddha and of Buddhism, is about impermanence. Everything changes. And I was realizing, of course, in studying this grief, that often, and maybe more often than not, when something changes, it changes in a way that we don't want it to change. Sometimes it changes for the better. Tonight, I hadn't opened these books up before I put them in the car to double check that the papers were inside. And I had a busy day, and I just sort of skipped that step. And so a couple times during dinner, the idea arose for me is, I wonder if the papers are in there. And then, that would be quite interesting if they're not. And so so as I opened them up, the papers were out of order, so I just rearranged them. But I had a pleasant response to something changing, not an unpleasant one. But if those papers hadn't been there, that twinge, that resistance, that unhappiness is a mini grief. And so understanding that everything changes, and I actually have faith that that's so. I also have experience that that's so, but I have faith beyond my experience that that's so. I saw a possibility of studying in every moment, or in the moments when I'm able to be aware of change, of studying the mini griefs, the small griefs, practicing change as a kind of an exercising, a strengthening of the strength that I need, and I think that we all need to meet the cataclysmic changes that occur, or that seem to occur, when something precious dies. Or, well, what are those precious things? Loved ones. The planet. The planet is a precious thing that's in the sickness process right now. Is it dying? We don't know. But it's kind of sick. The planet is kind of sick. People we read about all the time in war, all those refugees. What was it? 300,000 people coming to the island of Lesbos, which is more than are on the island right now, of Syrian refugees. Is that true? Could that be true? It's beyond thinking, right? So this is pain, and this is change, and this is changing in a way, change of something that we don't want to change. So what occurred to me was, it would be really probably a good idea to start right where I am, with this practice, with this preparation, with the moment-to-moment resistance to something new. So it isn't even just the kind of regret that something has changed into a form or feeling or sensation or an idea that I don't like or smell. It's, I don't like it to change at all. And I'm maybe not so different from you. Grief is sticky. Grief is heavy. And we need to practice. We need help, but of practice to meet it, to meet grief with balance and with respect. I found some definitions of grief. One I liked, I didn't put down ones I didn't like. One I liked says, grief is the conflicting feelings caused by the end of or change in a familiar pattern or behavior. So it's comfy right now. It's familiar. Any change in that has some grief attached to it. Grief is from a word that has a base word in it that means heavy. That means a burden. And it also is related to the word unjust. Can you feel that in grief? Can you feel that? That response, that kind of pulling away. This isn't fair. Today, I was in a meeting, which is not unusual, and I was sitting across from this person. I really like this person. This person is really helpful to me, and I pay attention to how she acts because I have a lot to learn from her. She's quite wonderful. We're sitting in this meeting, and on the shelf, quite a bit above her head, this stone Buddha head fell. No provocation. There wasn't an earthquake. Nothing happened. And it fell, and it went right by the back of her head and fell onto the floor. It was about that big, solid stone. And I noticed it when it was partway down the bookshelf, up still above her head. I saw it. I couldn't move. If I'd been taller, I might have been able to reach beyond her head and stop anything, but as it happened, it missed her. And I said, "That could have knocked you out." And she said, "It could have killed me." So I'm still feeling all that in my body and mind. And, you know, that could have happened a few hours ago in my world system, in our world system, this being out. So would that, would I have felt that was unjust? Oh my God, yes. No. However, the teaching is that change is merely change. Grief is resistance to and regret of change. So there's some steps I want to share with you for you to consider around working with grief. But before I mention them, I want to also say there may be some people here today who are in active stages of grief. And it's a little bit dangerous to talk about something like this in an open group where I don't really know you all and don't know what's going on in your life. So if you are in an active stage of grief, please allow the pain to be soothed by the coolness of your breath. And allow the presence of the community to hold you. But if my suspicion is correct, and you're like me, there's no one in this room who hasn't recently, like 30 seconds ago, experienced a minor withdrawal from a relatively small dissatisfaction of a moment of pleasure leaving, or a flicker of discomfort arising. And why do we withdraw? Well, it's our habit. It's our human habit. So because it's a habit, you need to practice to actually shift it. So step number one, first, if you can, sit down. And allow that kind of primitive longing for permanence to be felt. This longing for permanence, or the avoidance of the approach of non-being that we think of as death, this is suffering. And it's our human habit to cling to an idea that we're a stable, unchanging, permanent entity, and construct then mechanisms around that to support the idea. Confusion and discontent arise from the misconception that we are a noun, something from which something is removed. But we are a verb. We are change. Pema Chodron, an amazing teacher with beautifully accessible writing, says, to be fully alive, to be fully human and completely awake, is to be continually thrown out of the nest. To live fully is to be always in no man's land, to experience each moment as completely new and fresh. To live is to be willing to die over and over and over again. So your teacher mentioned that I've been at Zen Center a while, and I have been, but I think a little bit of the story of how I got there is apropos of this talk tonight. So I didn't write it down. How I came to Zen Center, and then it goes up to the next page. So I think I know this one without having it written down. I was enjoying my life and had a lot of momentum in my life. And then in an 18-month period of time, I experienced loss on just about every level of my life and sort of every territory of my life. My mother died. My business partner got mad at me, and I had to get a lawyer, and I had to shut my company down right when I was about ready. I had investors coming in, I was going to grow it. So my dream, I had to shut it down. My son moved out of the house to move to LA to get married. The man that I was seeing, it was really clear he was having monogamy issues, shall we say. So that wasn't going to work. And my father decided that it would be a good idea to get married again 6 months after my mother died. This was his idea of a good idea. And because my mother had died in the winter and we were from Vermont, we waited, we cremated her, and then we were all going to go to Vermont when you can actually dig in the ground and to bury the ashes and have a memorial service in Vermont. So we planned that in April, and my brothers and I and my dad all flew to Vermont and then flew from there to Palm Springs the next weekend for his wedding. So this was all happening, this kind of emotional roller coaster. And the day before we left to go to Vermont to then go to Palm Springs, I found out I had breast cancer. Pretty much every piece that was functioning fell apart in my life. And so what did I do? There are a couple choices in a situation like this, at least if you're a person like me. And the two kind of questions, the two kind of possibilities for me were, one is, well, what can I do about this? And the second is, what's the practice to meet this? And because I had been exposed to Buddhism and to some teachings for about 4 or 5 years, 6 years, I think, before this time, just like you, had the life, came and sat and listened, I was able to say, what's the practice to meet this? Not that the solution mind didn't come up. It tried. It really tried. I'll move into Zen Center. That's what I'll do. I'll move into Zen Center. I'll give everything away. None of this makes any sense. But these were solutions, you know. I was going to have a control over the situation by deciding what I was going to do. And I'll just be here for a couple months while I fly to New York and see if I can, you know, I'm trying to get a job at William Morris Agency in New York. I fly back, I am a Zen monk, theatrical agent. That was the range of my life at that point in time. And so, still moving, still looking for solutions, still thinking that this was, there was something I could do about all this pain to avoid it. One day, and actually it was the development office, I was asked to come and help in the development office because I'd had some experience. And I think because of the meditation, because of the being held by the community, I rolled up in a ball on the floor of the office in a fetal position. And I started weeping. The kind of crying where your diaphragm is kind of jumping up into your chest because you're sobbing so hard. That kind of weeping. And I think it went on for half an hour. And people were just walking over me. You know, because this is what happens in a Zen Center. This is what happens when you stop. And stop trying to avoid, when I stop trying to avoid the pain, the grief of change. And I am totally grateful that somehow all the conditions of my life and the teachings I had heard and the kindness and that there was a room available and that, you know, I said, I'm coming for 2 months. Well, that isn't even a program. You don't come for 2 months. I was coming for 2 months. And they kind of smiled at me and invited me in. And I felt the warmth and the support of community. And somehow I knew it was okay to fall apart. Not to skip over like a stone over the water, you know, over my grief, over all the loss. Practice isn't about avoiding the pain. Practice is about practicing the pain, turning into it, not exaggerating it, not dwelling there extra long. But if it's there, don't run away. And, you know, the circumstances that I recommend are first, sit down. First, stop. If it means lying on the floor and rolling up in the fetal position, do it. If it just means reaching out and holding your best friend's hand, do it. Stop. So, I've written the word down here. I was talking about many things I didn't write down here, so I'm going to go back to this for a minute because there's a word in here I want to share with you, which is here's the sentence. At the end of our ego's human effort to get back into control of the situation is the option of surrender. Not giving up, but surrendering. And that kind of surrender, in this case, surrendering into the grief, contains the possibility of peace and ease. Going through to the other side. And again, you may need to take this on faith. I have both experience and faith. So the practice, the answer to how do we practice with this loss or with this resistance to loss or fear of loss? And I say surrender. But surrender to what? And here's the it's kind of a carrot and stick situation. So to stop and not avoid the grief, it is painful. There is pain. That's kind of the stick, you know? Just sit in it. Okay, ouch, all right, I'm not going to move, I'm going to stay with this. But the carrot, that comes with the surrender is love. So surrender means to stop protecting myself from what might happen. And why do I say it's surrender to love? Because love isn't something that we do. It's what we actually are. A while ago I said we're a verb, we are change. Well, we also are love. And this kind of love takes no effort whatsoever. It's what's revealed to us when we stop resisting. Just stop resisting. Stop trying to make it better or worse, which is another form of control. When I'm able to surrender, or to allow surrender to happen, the pressure that I feel building up kind of in the marrow of my bones releases itself, and buoyancy rises. Surrender and buoyancy are related, I find. We do not need to be exhausted by change if we're not fighting what is. To strengthen the possibility of this surrender arising, it's helpful to do zazen. So I didn't outline the steps as I was talking, but I'm going to say them to you now. The steps that are one recipe for working with grief. First, stop. And you've all gotten yourself here, haven't you? You've all stopped something to be here. So stop. And then gently acknowledge and bear witness to the pain without judgment. And when you're ready, study. Become familiar with the promise of change and the freedom from anxiety and the love available in the space in between things. And then open the fearful heart to the stillness, which is love. I'm going to read you a poem that says both of these things. It's called The Big Heart, and it's by Anne Sexton. Big heart. Wise as a watermelon, but wise as birth. There is so much abundance in the people I have. Max, Lois, Joe, Louise, Carolina, Les, Arlene, Father Dunn, and all in their short lives give to me repeatedly in the way that the sea places its many fingers on the shore again and again. And they know me. They help me unravel. They listen with ears made of conch shells. They speak back with the wine of the best region. They are my staff. They comfort me. They hear how the artery of my soul has been severed. The soul is spurting out upon them, bleeding on them, messing up their clothes, dirtying their shoes. And God is filling me. Though there are times of doubt as hollow as the Grand Canyon, still God is filling me. He is giving me the thought of dogs, the spider in its intricate web, the sun in all its amazement, and a slain ram that is the glory, the mystery of great cost. And my heart, which is very big, I promise you it is very large, a monster of sorts, takes it all in, and all in comes the fury of love. So, grief doesn't have to go away for love to arrive. This is the secret. Don't push grief to the side in order to just feel the love. Love can come up and touch us if we're still and if we don't resist the pain of the grief, the pain of change. Stop. Gently acknowledge and bear witness to the pain without judgment. When you're ready, study. Study the essence of what it is to be a human being and the possibility of freedom and the love available in the space between things. And open the fearful heart to the stillness, which is love. So that's pretty much the talk I meant to give. And is it appropriate to ask for questions if people would like to bring something up, either about this or anything else? Yes.
I would just like to thank you so much for sharing with us your personal experience and your experiences of grief. And everything that you've said about grief, I think many of us have experienced. And it just resonates with so many of us. And it's really wonderful. Thank you.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the idea of study.
Study? What do you want to know about study? While I was part of this group of teachers, although I was the least qualified to be in the group, and we were teaching about grief, the fact that I had studied the basic teachings of Buddhism was a fairly important factor in that idea occurring to me that the small changes are practices for the big changes. So because I had, when I moved into Zen Center and realized that I was making a complete shift in my life, I ask myself, well, how can I do this? What is it about this? Because I've had a pretty full life. And the thing that hit me the most about where I've gotten myself, besides the community and the ability to grieve, was this is a limitless study. There's no end to the study that's available about being a human being, about what is it that makes us a human being, and what are the possibilities for freedom. There's no end to that path of curiosity. So for me, it made total sense to engage with something that I'm not going to ever come to the end of. And so I get quite excited about study, because it's about the most important, that this study, let's say the study of being a human being and freedom from the difficulties of being a human being, is something that helps me, and if I understand it, maybe I can help other people. So studying can come in the form of reading a book or listening. So that's one doorway for study. And the second is discussion, conversation with a teacher, with your friends, back and forth. Discourse is study. And then the final kind of way of study is embodying the concepts. And in this case, the concepts are, the concept that we embody is beyond concepts. So that's, Zazen is that kind of study. Embodying the concepts, but it's conditioned by our minds exploring the questions of what is it to be a human being and to be free. Yes.
Thank you for the talk. And while you were talking, I was thinking, you've been in filmmaking, I've done quite a lot of filmmaking too, and one of the things that I've come to realize is, you know, when you roll the camera and film is running through the camera, and this is actual film rolling, running through the camera, you can do take, till the canister runs out. You can put another canister in and do some more takes. And when you get into the editing room, you can take out all the bad parts. Life is not like that. Life is just come that you full force and cannot be edited, like you just, what you just shared with us. Just, you know, it's there. You can't just take it and go, oh, this doesn't fit, so I'm going to take it out. It just, you know, I just came to realize that it's a very shared and real experience that people have, even those people who have been moved to that island of Lesbos. They can't just edit that out. They are, this is there, this is complete, this is whole, this is something that cannot be just, you know, erased somehow. And it's very real. And that's, I think, dealing with that in real life is just, like you said, it's really meeting. It's just about meeting yourself.
If we meet each moment, we don't get overwhelmed. If we start to think about all the details of some of the, you know, losses and difficulties and pain, we're in the conceptual realm about it, and we can make ourselves quite miserable. Mm-hmm. But right now, just meeting each other, that's one thing. I could tell you were a filmmaker by the way you put the light on me. So, thank you very much. Yes.
I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about what you said about sort of the grief, and that the grief isn't over yet when the love arises, mm-hmm. and kind of And if it's relevant, what is the role of self-acceptance?
You know, I think when we're in those, so maybe for the tape, what she asked was about, you know, talking a little bit more about the love arising before the grief goes away and maybe self-acceptance in the relationship. I actually think that when we're in grief, the concept of self-acceptance is no match for grief. It's kind of obliterated, you know. The concern, the self-concern is so blown out of the water. And so that's the other reason. It's like when we're so inundated with loss, we have the great possibility of the self not being in the way. And when the self isn't in the way, trying to control things, amp it up, amp it down, not like it, not like itself, you know, all those little tricks that it does, we're in a more I'm going to use the word holy, sanctified state, where we have access to, you know, there's all this pain, but then the doorway, it's like Dharma gates, right? Delusions are inexhaustible and Dharma gates are endless, and guess what? They're related. All those endless delusions and endless Dharma gates are completely connected. So being in that kind of wide open, still place of accepting the pain is the same position that allows the love to fill us. Sitting still is the position where love fills us and pain fills us. It all happens when we sit still. I don't know if that answered your question.
Oh, makes sense.
Carolina. Thank you for coming and thank you for your talk. I just wanted to share something. In my experience, I've always thought that the smiles of the people that are grieving are the sweetest.
I wonder if what the relationship is of loss and love in that area. So we're feeling the pain because we love what we lost, right? Mm-hmm. So it does evoke love, and maybe that's that bittersweet. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't miss something you don't love. Maybe. Thank you.
I have a question. You told us pretty much your kind of all your life in this speech. And
1 year of it.
Well, everything came to a certain point and had to change. And the question I have is, you don't have to answer, but your sickness that was, you were diagnosed and so on, how much practice has then contributed to healing? Did you have to go to regular medical practices, or you had internal transformation that kind of healed your body on its own? And was there a big lesson for you that there was certain thought going in a negative direction that had to blow up, so you found it low that you needed, and that brought up to some healing point that you covered maybe. That's how I see what happened. That's what God tells us, if you want.
So the question is about the breast cancer that I mentioned and whether what the healing process was and whether it was alternative and what were the lessons. And so I'm going to tell you the lesson I learned from it. And it wasn't, I didn't use, let's put it this way. When I heard the words cancel, everything shifted in terms of my view of myself, because I was now inside a statistic instead of outside the statistic looking in. So I was now part of a group that I had always felt was other. So that was really interesting, that shift. And then one of the first things that came up for me, because I had been introduced to practice in it, like I said, maybe 6 years, I had been increasing my participation and my study and doing more and more sessions. And my first thought was, I don't want to pray to get better, because that will sully my practice. Because what I understood at the time was that I shouldn't ought to try to want something different from what was. And I was so concerned about injuring my practice. And I didn't know how to work with that, because I also didn't want to die. So I went to see my teacher to ask him that question, and his attendant was waiting outside, and I asked her first, and I said, I don't know what to do. I don't want to pray, and I don't want to die, and I don't know what to do with this energy of like wanting to pray, or wanting to ask to not die. Who, I don't know, but that arising of wanting to ask to not die. So she told me about this, about, I knew of Thomas Merton, but I hadn't read his books, and she told me about his book on contemplative prayer, which is a prayer that's very much like Zazen in a way. You just are totally immersed and present. And you're not praying for something, but your energy is completely concentrated and open, and probably open to love, right? Instead of open to wanting, to grasping, to not wanting it to be so. So that instruction helped me tremendously to settle into the process. And in that case, it was mostly Western medicine, radiation, those kind of things, some surgery. And how that affected the long term, you know, I don't know, I'm fine, I've been fine for 25, 30 years. But that was interesting to me that I cared that much about my practice. So that's what I learned.
Well, thanks for sharing. It's very interesting.
Maybe one more? Yes.
Thank you for your talk. Can you talk a little bit about the transition from, you know, Hollywood filmmaking to Zen and how that? Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember reading this article about Steven Spielberg. He was doing like 3 movies, and he kind of forgot about reality. Like, he was so, he was like Raiders of the Lost Ark and all these other movies, and he just kind of forgot that was like, that's all fake. You know, that's not real. So, can you talk a little bit about the transition of, you know, filmmaking and Zen practice?
I can, again, I'll answer a piece of that. So, because people ask me this a lot, like, how could you do that thing, you know? Like, and the way in which I was a filmmaker was that I was most interested, I just didn't want to be a producer. I only wanted to do the things I wanted to do. So, and what was important to me was finding stories that told a truth that either had not been told before, or had not been told in that way, or could be told in a more disruptive way. So that kind of word truth, you know, which is pretty subjective, but that resonating with this is real, this is true, this is important for humans to think about, feel, etc. That was the underlying value in my filmmaking life. So I only wanted, and I was lucky, those are the kind of projects I did. I only did that. So it's the same thing with Zen, except it's endless. You know, this, what is the truth? My name, my Dharma name, is Zesho, which means it's two characters, and the sho is one of the words for truth, and the Zet is just an exclamation point. And that's what my teacher gave me. He said it's called Star of Truth. But that's the most, that's very important to me, is to explore that with everybody. Not that I know it, but to explore it and to try to find ways for people's eyes to be opened and hearts to be opened and to be more human. So that's the connection. It wasn't a big leap, really. It's close to nine. So we said, let's see.
Thank you, Susan.
You're welcome.